many of the bikes which he had ridden, and that he viewed himself as an expert on motorcycles and had had many bikes that had shimmied and had wobbled, and that he was an expert at pulling them out of shimmies and wobbles, and he understood that bikes shimmied and wobbled. And I presume that the jury concluded that since he already knew what they claimed that they should have warned him about, that even had there been a problem which they didn't find, they didn't find it wobbled. But had they found out, I don't see that there would be causation since he already knew. Now, if I mentioned that I think the plaintiff lost this case not because of anything which was done or undone, but because of credibility. I've mentioned some of the things and the variety of approaches that the plaintiff took at various points in time as to what happened. But for instance, their eyewitness, which they mentioned, testified, gentlemen, that he had given 18 or 20 different versions of what happened and had not told the truth in any of them, and only told the truth when he was when it was something that was serious, and he didn't regard that the fact that people had taken statements from him and a variety of things in which he admitted giving such statements as not even seeing the accident. They put this fellow on who said he saw the handlebars go 90 degrees and 90 degrees to support wobble, when the bike itself is manufactured with stops where it can't move the 15 or 20 degrees, something like that. And this is the man that Mr. Mattioni had spent a great deal of time with and testified to the jury that he gradually began to see the light and understood what had really happened out there. Although the people that had been in the car with him, one of whom testified that they didn't see the wreck. And that the person who was testifying that he had seen the wreck never told, they stopped at the wreck and helped the guy, but they hadn't seen the wreck, they'd been behind the wreck. And credibility items like that, it seems to me, hurt a lot. Now, add on top of that such things as, and I think the man's name was Amos Goshlin or something like that, an old employee of Yamaha that they got to come and testify, who had a wonderful memory, Amos said, that he remembered things that happened 8, 9, 10, 11 years ago, and when they were doing this, that, and the other thing with the motorcycles, and back when the 71s and the 72s and 73s, and he remembered conversations where they tried to warn people about this and about that. And Amos had a wonderful memory. On cross-examination, I asked Amos about his memory, and he bragged on it. But Amos could not remember what town he was in. He could not remember the name of the town on which he sat on the witness stand. And such things, it seems to me, add up and begin to look, and we cite cases to the court where people admit that they have told various and sundry different stories, where it's proper to argue that there is some fooling around with evidence going on, some fabrication, and I stand before this court believing that all was not particularly above board with respect to the believability or integrity of some of those witnesses. I don't believe this court could read the record and not concur to a considerable extent with that. Now, if there are any group of people that know that we have an adversary system by which we decide these matters and juries to decide the disputed facts, it's you gentlemen. And one of the things that adversaries must do is at least make objections to try and help the court and guide the court. I don't think the court was in error in anything it did anyway, but everything that they complain about, they either did it themselves first or they made no objection. Let me get to the alcohol consumption. And all of this is covered in the reply and with some cases, but they filed a motion in limine to keep us from talking about alcohol, and since that just goes to approaching the bench, we agreed to it, and they opened the voir dire telling this jury that this man had been drinking beer and qualifying the jury on that. They next put Mr. McGinnis on the stand and had him testify that he drank six beers. At that point, if alcohol is not in the case, I can't imagine how it could be more solidly in the case. We had hospital records which showed a blood alcohol of 0.134, I think, or a considerable amount of alcohol in the blood. And there was a DPS finding of 0.09, as I recall. They complain about something that they have clearly waived by offering. They next complain that Dr. Rupp was allowed to speculate on the effect of that alcohol. And I challenge anyone to find an objection where the plaintiff made any objection to Rupp speculating on the effect of alcohol and the amount of alcohol. The only objection that is in that record is, I object, Your Honor, Dr. Rupp is not an expert motorcycle rider. He doesn't know about motorcycles. That's the only objection that is in that record dealing with the offer of alcohol. There was never any objection when he testified as to what Frank Martin, neurosurgeon, what it meant to be slightly intoxicated. There is ample evidence in the record that when you come into the hospital with 0.09 and an hour later you're 0.134, that you had a lot of alcohol before you got on that bike because your alcohol level was going up. And 4 hours later, when Martin saw him, he was still slightly intoxicated, fits the pattern of absorption of the alcohol. And in any event, we have no objection in this record at all to Dr. Rupp testifying as to what that man meant by that, and if it is wrong, in there, it seems to me the plaintiff owed the court at least an objection. It was at least speculative, could they have said? Could they have objected? Now, they next say that there was no... aberrant conduct, no strange conduct on the part of this motorcycle rider that ought to allow the under the cases cited. And I don't quarrel with the decisions. I simply quarrel with the we had a bright sunshiny day, a man well familiar with the area who told the jury he had six beers and climbed on his bike and drove a mile and went straight at the first curve he came to. Now, it seems to me that where the evidence shows that he knows, and this is not just an exit ramp, this is where the highway splits two ways, and what he did is he went straight, absolutely as straight as he could go. And it doesn't seem to me you could have more evidence of strange or aberrant kind of conduct than going straight on a clear day. That's his testimony at the time of trial. He said he counted the pavement, although the witness Smith, with his 18 versions of what happened, said the motorcycle fell over and hit it some 100 feet across the road and bounced over the railing. The plaintiff said that he never fell down, that he went straight and drove off the road. So it looks to me like we had plenty of aberrant type of conduct. The exclusion of Leo Lake's testimony, the court will notice in the there is no offer of proof as to what Leo Lake would have said or would not have said. The court will remember that this jury found defect against us and for the plaintiff. Since there was no offer of proof as to what Leo Lake was said, it seemed to me that was the last of it, until I find that on motion for new trial, they have attached Leo Lake's third deposition, and I tell this court honestly, I don't know if that's a proper preservation of that or not. I never even thought about it because I didn't think it was attached until I found it, or Ms. Snapke found it the other day. But Leo Lake...
Well, let me ask you this. Was the deposition offered at trial, or portions offered at trial as a bill of exception?
No, Your Honor. Not a word.
Okay, the first time it was offered, was it a motion to rehear?
Yes, sir.
If it was offered then?
Well, it was, it's attached to the same.
If that's an offer.
It's attached to the transcript. The curious thing about that is that if you look at the statement of facts, Judge Utter and myself, Mr. Johnson, who had been out in California some 6 weeks with the Mattionis taking depositions, had called us. The time was expiring for discoveries or going 10 hours a day, that kind of thing. And Mr. Johnson in my office had an agreement with the Mattionis that he would produce these people in Philadelphia after the time for discovery had closed, but that it was well known that Mr. Lake could not be at the trial, so that Richard would have a chance to get his testimony in. Mr. Mattioni examined him most of the day, and at 5 o'clock told Richard, and this is in the record, that the deposition is over and we will not continue it and we will not attend your cross-examination. The court knew of that agreement, and the court ruled knowing of that agreement. But since they offered no offer of proof, we didn't offer the agreement, and you have only the fact that the court knew of some agreement, and you don't know what it is by the statement of facts. And it's very curious what a court might do when the parties have an agreement that they will do something like that when that testimony is excluded. But in any event, Leo Lake says in that third deposition that was excluded absolutely nothing that is admissible on the issue of producing cause, which is the issue that they lost on, causation. Leo Lake totally contradicts their position that the wobbles can occur at slow speeds, and in fact, in the deposition, which is attached as part of the transcript, says that he is not aware. He says on page, most of this is page 68 through 72, if the court is interested. He says he didn't believe that wobbles happen at lower speeds, and not aware of corner problems, and certainly not at 30 miles an hour, and that he, you know, things of that nature. Now, I can't imagine why that would be admissible or probative of specific causation. There wasn't any doubt that the jury had a right to hear the eyewitnesses and the fact witnesses, but this man knows nothing of whether it occurred at that time and can offer nothing as to a probative value as to what occurred at that time. And if we did, it was against their position. That's about all I have to say.
I realize that it's not in the case before us. It was apparently a point of error in the Court of Appeals. I'm concerned about this apparent $26,000 sanction assessed against you or your client. How long did the refusal to answer comply with discovery take? Over what period did you fail to comply with discovery?
You know, Judge, I had no part of that hearing, and I wasn't out there doing that, and I rather than speculate on it, I don't know how much of a time period it involved, rather than a failure to give some microfilm records, if my memory serves me correctly. And if I'm wrong about that, I sure apologize for it. But
Court of Appeals opinion says that over a 2-year period, several motions for sanctions were filed.
Could be.
Were they all filed as to the same failure to comply with discovery, or was it varying discovery requests?
Well, frankly, I didn't know but about one, and I just can't answer that, Your Honor.
It's not before us on application for a little bit.
Well, I wish I could answer it, but I can't just. Okay. Warning means I have 5 minutes. I have nothing more to say if there are no more questions.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear rebuttal from the petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Spivey will present the rebuttal argument for the petitioner.
May it please the court. Counsel for respondent is correct, I think. Except, and that is on the tender of Blake deposition testimony, except counsel for respondent filed a motion in limine requesting that Mr. Lake's deposition be excluded. The record shows Mr. Mattione was asking permission to tender that testimony, and that the court ruled on the motion in limine that that was not admissible and would not be gone into in front of the jury. Now, I'm not obviously as familiar with the record as counsel for respondent is, and I think probably that there was not an actual tender in front of the jury, but it's my understanding, and I don't have a case at hand, that when the tender is made, that the court rules that the evidence is inadmissible, then the tender does not have to be made in front of the jury.
Or was it made?
At the time of trial.
At the time
yes.
of trial? But you understand the rule, of course, that a ruling on in limine does not control.
I understand that, except that this is a ruling at the time of the trial that's outside the presence of the jury, but the court ruled that he couldn't go into it in front of the jury.
Was that on the nature of a motion in limine?
Yes, sir.
Well, whether the court ruled or not that he couldn't go in to the matter, Lake's testimony in front of the jury, did either Mr. Mattione or Mr. Pletcher offer into evidence outside of the presence of the jury the deposition testimony of Lake?
I do not. This is an extremely voluminous record. I simply cannot. I don't have an independent recollection of that. My recitation of that would just simply not be reliable. The issue on Dr. Rupp's testimony on the as the court of appeals said, the medical examiner then took the 0.1% figure and extrapolated. That's the court of appeals terminology. And I thought I knew what extrapolated was, but I went to Webster's to see, and that says that extrapolated is to infer from values within an already observed interval. To infer values of a variable in an unobserved interval from values within an already observed interval. And then it speaks a little plainer English and says, to project, extend, or expand known data or experience into an area not known or experienced so as to arrive at a usually conjectural knowledge of the unknown area.
I believe I like the other doctor's definition of what he meant by slightly intoxicated.
It's a little bit more understandable. But I really think that Dr. Rupp's testimony, it's probably the more interesting and presents something that we lawyers and judges can chew around and chew on each other with, that there's another thing that I think is far more persuasive in this case, and that is the posture of the case as it appears before the Supreme Court at this time. And in order to do that, to examine that, I think we need to look first at the verdict of the jury and the law of product liability at the time of this jury verdict, which was June 26, 1981. The jury found the motorcycle was defective, that Yamaha failed to give adequate warnings of the dangerous condition. Then here's the important one, because I'm going to ask this court to find as a matter of law to the contrary, the jury's finding. The jury said it was not a producing cause. And I think this is a question in this case of producing cause and whether it is as a matter of law, and I'm going to point out very briefly why I think it is. The jury found also that the motorcycle did not develop an uncontrolled wobble. That's not a necessary finding, but it's a finding that I'm willing to meet head on, because I think that the finding must square itself with the uncontroverted evidence before the jury. They found that the plaintiff failed to keep a proper lookout. The only significance of that is that's negligence, and in 1981, at the time of this opinion, that was no defense to a product liability case. And then they found that that was a proximate cause and found damages of $3,920,500. Now, the first thing I want to look at in asking this court to take that step begins on page 68 of our brief. and I want to carry through the steps. Number one, that contributory negligence was not a defense. Number two, and this is powerfully important, the defendant did not seek or obtain any instruction or finding from the jury that his, quote, failure to keep a proper lookout, which they found, but they found it was negligent. He didn't ask that they find that it was a sole cause, sole proximate cause, or sole producing cause, any one of which might have been a defense. The next step is, what is the standard by which a jury's conduct is to be measured by this court? And that is, a jury is not free to ignore clear, direct, and compelling evidence that a product defect caused or contributed to cause an injury or an event, the citation given. And then, and I know it's always dangerous to cite this court, a case decided by this court, but it's a good case. The law is, when you even viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, a producing cause was established as a matter of law. I don't have a producing cause. I don't have a white horse case to cite this court, but I got a pinto horse with a lot of white in it, and it's an opinion by Judge McGee. That is the Mon, M-O-U-G-H-O-N, case that's cited, decided by this court in 1978. That court dealt with negligence as a matter of law, but I submit the principles are entirely the same. In that case, the jury found that the defendant wasn't negligent, and the Court of Civil Appeals reversed and rendered that judgment, held that the plaintiff had conclusively established it, and then Judge McGee goes on to discuss the rule and says, accordingly, we must determine whether the statutory violation was conclusively established in the present case and concomitantly whether there was any evidence of a legally acceptable excuse to the statutory violation. They were dealing with statutory violation, and we've got the same rules. It's a question of violation we're dealing with here. And here's what's important in that case. The testimony was, because I'm going to show you where that's entirely consistent in this case, the plaintiff's father testified, quote, her father further testified that the car only pulled to the right when the brakes were applied, otherwise it maintained a steady course. And then the court says at best, it talks about the defendant's evidence and the defendant's argument. At best, this is only evidence of an unexplained loss of control. Ms. Mon's burden was to present some evidence, not only of her loss of control, but that the loss of control was due to a legally acceptable reason. It is well settled in this state that proximate cause exists as a matter of law if the circumstances are such that reasonable minds could not differ. We have pointed out to this court, and it starts with a recitation of the evidence, and I believe that is on page 10, 9, I guess it is, of our brief. There's two witnesses whose testimony was before the jury. Unlike the arguments over the evidence which was not admitted, these are both former employees. There was not, as Mr. Allison inferred, one former employee, but there were two former employees, and these were not incidental employees. One was Mr. Randy Nelson, the former service manager and warranty manager of Yamaha. The other was Mr. Amos Garland, the former customer complaints manager. And this is their testimony, and I'll say it succinctly by referring to our brief. They testified without contradiction that from the time of the first production in 1970 until 1974, there were 650 complaints of deficiency in design that caused the wobble. Two, that Yamaha had actual knowledge of the defective design before 1974 because of the numerous complaints of wobbling. Three, that in 1974 they redesigned the frame of the 650 to increase its strength. That Yamaha did not notify owners of the 1970 and 73 motorcycles of the changes. They received approximately a complaint a day.
Counsel, do you agree with the statement made by respondents that the undisputed proof in this case is that the Yamaha went straight instead of turning?
No. And that's an entirely appropriate question, because it's at the point time I was about to make the next point, and that is, you now couple the testimony of those two witnesses from the company with the one eyewitness, not related to, directly or indirectly, our client. He was an Army sergeant traveling a few feet behind Mr. McGinnis. His testimony, uncontradicted, is, number one, that the plaintiff signaled as they were approaching a turn to the right. It's sort of an expressway. It is an expressway that turns right in Corpus Christi. The plaintiff signaled a turn. Two, he moved from the center to the right lane. Three, he slowed down. Four, he was driving very well. Five, suddenly the front of a motorcycle began wobbling and he went off the roadway. That is the uncontradicted testimony from a disinterested witness, and that's what creates the posture of this case, Your Honors, which I submit to this court not only justifies, but under the principles enunciated by this Supreme Court in the case that I just cited, Mr. Justice McGee's opinion and Mon versus Wolf, justifies a reversal and rendition of this case.
But Mr. Allison says that Sergeant Smith gave 18 different versions of how the accident happened. Are the other versions in the record?
I will assume that the term 18 was
I'm not pinning it to 18, but I assume it means more than one other version of how the accident happened.
His versions of how the accident happened are not inconsistent. That was the testimony that he gave at the trial in front of the jury. That testimony is referred to in our brief and the citation given. Now, I've never had a witness that told the same, quote, story exactly identical. But it's important to review that, just as Mr. Allison is pointing out, we're talking about the posture of the cases that appeared in front of the court, in front of the jury. That's what I'm talking about now. That's the evidence. That's the evidence that was before the jury.
I want to know, is there any other statement by Smith before the jury that would imply that the accident occurred in a different manner?
In cross-examination, counsel had Mr. Smith, and Mr. Smith acknowledged that he had described it in different versions before, but there's no such inference that can be drawn, I think, that there was impeachment, that is, prior inconsistent statements, because it's a different thing to impeach a witness or to have impeached a witness when you show the witness told something diametrically opposed to what he says now, as opposed to the common experience of a witness describing it using different adjectives, adverbs, terminology in describing it. And that's the sole difference that Mr. Allison is making, trying to make a very substantial point. But the truth is, the direct and the uncontroverted evidence that I have just read is the evidence that was before the jury. Now, when you couple that evidence with the defendant's former employee's testimony, uncontroverted, unimpeached, then you have a situation, Your Honors, that I submit to this court that as a matter of law compels the court to say that the jury is simply not at liberty to disregard evidence that is controlling, because I think it is apparent that there's some evidence why the jury avoided that. And I believe in the adversarial system, and I believe that Mr. Allison is one of the most skillful attorneys and competent attorneys, and I like Mr. Allison, but I do think Mr. Allison went too far in this case, and I think that explains and would explain as a matter of common sense why the jury followed his approach to the defense of this case, but the jury's not entitled to that
question. Another question. The Court of Appeals said it was error to exclude Lake's testimony. Right.
Yes.
But said it wasn't harmful error.
Yes.
All right. Was this matter as to the making of a bill of exception raised in the Court of Appeals? Apparently the Court of Appeals had to consider that in assessing error, but was the matter raised in the court that perhaps error had not been preserved?
Yes. It is my, and I want to look at counsel to be sure, it is my recollection that was presented to the Court of Appeals. The entire case was presented to the Court of Appeals, and that question was presented.
Your
Honor, but I might say this, but I don't think that it raised as a preservation of error question.
You may want to submit a letter brief on that both sides. Submit it for that very reason. That concludes the argument in the case. The court will take a 10-minute recess.